From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
10, 9, 8, Saddam Hussein 7, and his sons 6, must leave Iraq within 48 hours.
4, 3, 2, 1, and liftoff.
The United States has already had a busy day attacking Iraq.
We are in the early stages of the effort to disarm Iraq.
And it was shocking and it was awesome, as predicted by the Pentagon.
1 year ago, the bombs rained down on Baghdad. We'll go to Iraq to hear from a retired Iraqi engineer about life under occupation. We'll speak with two U.S. soldiers who were deployed in Iraq. We'll talk to journalist Christian Parenti, embedded with the U.S. military, and interviewed Iraqi resistance fighters.
Iraq today is impoverished and still very much at war.
And we go from San Francisco to New Mexico, New York to London to Spain as the protests continue.
We took to the streets because we tried marching, we tried voting, we tried petitions, we tried rallies, and they fell on the deaf ears and the numb hearts in Washington. And so we did what people have done throughout history to uproot injustice. We exercised our conscience directly.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A year ago tonight, the U.S. invasion of Iraq began. To mark the anniversary, scores of protests throughout the United States and the world are scheduled tomorrow as part of a global day of protest against war. In France, French Prime Minister Dominique de Villepin told the French newspaper Le Monde that, quote, the Iraq war hasn't led to a more stable world. And the president of Poland said he felt he was misled about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. But unlike other countries, including Spain and Honduras, Poland says it has no plans to pull its troops from Iraq. Meanwhile, Secretary of State General Colin Powell landed in Baghdad to mark this first anniversary. This morning, more than 20 Arab journalists walked out of a Powell press conference in Iraq, protesting the death of two Iraqi journalists from the Arabic news channel Al Arabiya, who were allegedly killed by the U.S. on Thursday. According to the station, one of their cameramen and correspondents witnessed a car accident between a U.S. vehicle and an Iraqi. Fearing a car bombing, they ran from the scene and were shot. The U.S. claimed it killed only one person when he tried to run through a checkpoint. Meanwhile, in northern Iraq, three Iraq journalists were killed by gunmen. They'd been working for a TV station funded by the U.S.-led coalition. In other Iraq news, the BBC is reporting the Bush administration fired General Jay Garner from overseeing the Iraq occupation last year because he advocated for free elections and rejected privatizing Iraqi industries. He told the BBC, quote, my preference was to put the Iraqis in charge as soon as we can and do it with some form of elections. I just thought it was necessary to rapidly get the Iraqis in charge of their destiny. In Pakistan, near the Afghanistan border, thousands of Pakistani soldiers, with U.S. help, have launched an offensive against a large group of suspected al-Qaeda members who are cornered in an isolated mountain region. The U.S. has worked with the Pakistani forces by supplying Predator drones and U-2 spy planes. On Thursday, Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf said his troops had ringed a high-value target. The U.S. is hoping the target is Ayman al-Zawahiri, a top member of al-Qaeda, but there's little hard evidence he's there. Zawahiri is believed to be Osama bin Laden's spiritual advisor and doctor, as well as the architect of al-Qaeda's ideology. The U.S. has offered a $25 million reward for his capture. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, the House doubled its reward for capturing Osama bin Laden to $50 million. News of the possible capture came Thursday, just hours after Secretary of State Colin Powell announced in Pakistan the U.S. has upgraded Pakistan to, quote, major non-NATO ally status. This will make it easier for the country to buy U.S.-made weapons. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia issued a 21-page memo Thursday saying he would not recuse himself in a case involving Vice President Dick Cheney. Scalia had come under intense criticism after it was revealed he went duck hunting with Cheney at a time the court was deciding whether it should force Cheney to make the public minutes from his energy task force meetings. Scalia wrote, quote, "A rule that required members of this court to remove themselves from cases in which the official actions of friends were at issue would be utterly disabling." Meanwhile, 13 Republican members of Congress are now asking Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg to withdraw from all future cases related to abortion because she's spoken at events sponsored by the now legal Defense and Education Fund. In campaign news, Republican Senator John McCain broke with party ranks to defend Senator John Kerry's record on defense. McCain said, quote, "I do not believe that he is, quote, weak on defense. This kind of rhetoric, I think, is not helpful in educating and helping the American people make a choice." Despite the comment, McCain said he is still supporting Bush. On Wednesday, Vice President Cheney said, quote, "The senator from Massachusetts has given us ample doubts about his judgment and the attitude he brings to bear on vital issues of national security." In Taiwan, the country's president and vice president were both shot just hours before the country goes to the polls. The two were campaigning in an open-air motorcade. The president, Shen Shui-bian, was shot in the stomach, and his vice president, Annette Liu, was shot in the knee. Both were hospitalized and then released. Sunday's election is expected to proceed. In addition to choosing a president, voters will be asked if China should reduce its military threat against the island.
T-minus 15 seconds. T-minus 10, 9, 8,
Saddam Hussein 7, and his sons 6, must leave Iraq within 48 hours.
4, 3, 2, 1, and liftoff. Liftoff.
United States has already had a busy day attacking Iraq.
We are in the early stages of the effort to disarm Iraq.
And it was shocking and it was awesome, as predicted by the Pentagon.
Now, most of this noise at the end of this videotape sequence, the big explosions, or what I call the huge explosions, are believed to have been hits on something by Tomahawk missiles.
And we're taking reports in all the time from the streets.
San Francisco Indian Media's stream live from the mission.
All the demonstrators have a their own radio station. They are broadcasting, and they are, we assume they are listening to us. We are monitoring their broadcast. Yeah, test for them.
They really seem to like this intersection name of Bush and Powell.
Okay, down for it.
Anti-war activists just sat in the middle of the intersection. Police moved in quickly.
Thousands battled police in an effort to shut down downtown San Francisco.
Fremont, they got it all shut down.
They've taken over Venice and looks like Oak.
Yeah, they've also taken over Fell Street. They got more than what we can handle here.
To you, along with the anti-war protesters, there are simply people who seem to be seizing on an opportunity just to come out into the streets and simply maybe cause trouble?
Absolutely, Julie. They have told us they plan to be out here as long as American troops are attacking the Iraqis.
Traffic. They bound themselves together with pipes and duct tape.
Many laid down.
Now, students from high schools all over Oakland walked out.
Demonstrators took to the streets today in groups large and small.
We just heard news that Baghdad is being leveled right now, and I'd like us all to just have a few moments of silence.
Protesters made no bones about it early on, saying that they were going to shut down the city of San Francisco on the first day of the bombing. And in effect, they have done that.
We refuse to carry on business as usual while American soldiers and Iraqi civilians die under the machinery of war.
We
blocked the federal building and all entrances.
Live report from the federal building. You're live on the air on enemy combatant radio. Federal building, can you hear me?
Some of the protesters actually regurgitated and vomited at the federal building in some sort of a display to show them that the war made them sick. So that was happening as well today.
That's incredible.
Teamsters today abandoned big rigs in the intersection of Van Ness and Fell. We took to the streets because we tried marching, we tried voting, we tried petitions, we tried rallies, and they fell on the deaf ears and the numb hearts in Washington. And so we did what people have done throughout history to uproot injustice. We exercised our conscience directly. We communicated our message directly.
March 27th at 11:30 p.m.
This is Sam Green. I work with a bunch of people at Bechtel, and we hate you. You are on the wrong side of this war. 71% of the country supports Bush. You've got the wrong idea. We want you to stop demonstrating, stop bothering us. And your numbers are decreasing every day. The war is going forward, and it is not going to stop. So give it up, okay? You are on the wrong side. In fact, you are aiding and abetting Saddam Hussein. Aiding and abetting. You are accessories to murder. Give it up. Wrap it up. Go away.
We interrupt this empire. Excerpts of the video by San Francisco Video Activist Network. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On March 20th, 2003, approximately 5:35 a.m. Bagdad time, U.S. forces began raining down bombs on Iraq while thousands of U.S. and British soldiers began pouring across Iraq's borders. It was a year ago today, U.S. time. It was the official beginning of what the Bush administration hailed as a campaign of shock and awe. The attacks were not authorized by the United Nations. They were carried out over the loud and public objections of most of the world's nations and people. The bombing and invasion in Iraq were met with an almost immediate response of massive worldwide protest. A year later, the war in Iraq continues. Some would say it's only just begun. Perhaps as many as 10,000 Iraqi civilians have died. Resistance to the occupation has increased. U.S. soldiers continue to come home in body bags. According to the Pentagon's official estimates, more than 570 U.S. soldiers have been killed, more than 430 of these since George Bush landed on an aircraft carrier and declared an end to the major combat operations. According to the Pentagon, some 29,000 U.S. troops have either been killed, wounded, injured, or become so ill as to require evacuation from Iraq. That is close to the total of a whole army division. After Bush landed on the aircraft carrier last May 1st, he spoke to soldiers with a banner behind him that read, "Mission accomplished. No weapons of mass destruction have been found." The Bush administration has barred media organizations from filming the return of caskets from Iraq. President Bush has yet to attend a single funeral of a soldier killed in action in either Iraq or Afghanistan during his presidency. While he hasn't found time to attend any funerals, Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney attended some 100 campaign fundraisers in 2003, some of these on days when U.S. soldiers were being laid to rest. And while the body bags continue to come home, it remains Iraqis who pay the price of the occupation. There is no doubt that the situation in Iraq has grown more and more violent each day. The occupation continues, even though Saddam Hussein and his top leadership have been either killed or captured. Almost no day goes by without a bombing in Iraq, a U.S. soldier being killed, an Iraqi life being destroyed. Desertions from the U.S. Army have increased by 32%. Since 1999. By the end of 2003, the cost of the Iraq war to U.S. taxpayers was more than $100 billion. This weekend, people across the globe will mark the anniversary of the beginning of the invasion of Iraq. Today on the program, we'll hear from protest organizers around the world. We'll be joined by soldiers from the U.S. military, as well as Christian Parenti, embedded with U.S. military, also interviewed Iraqi resistance fighters. First, we're going to go to Baghdad to speak with Mark Levine, who is a professor, University of California, Irvine, was there while the bombing took place this week that took out, killed at least seven people. Can you tell us where you are now?
Yes, hi, Amy. I'm standing about half a kilometer away from the square where the main protest today gathered.
Can you tell us what that protest is about?
Well, the protest, which it started with about 5,000 people and wound down to about 1,000 to 2,000. It was sponsored by the founding National Iraqi National Conference, which has basically been set up in the last few weeks as an alternative to the Governing Council, or what they call the Governed Council. And it's basically the goal is to fight against the occupation and create an alternative political and social structure to the transitional regime that is supposedly taking power on the 1st of July.
What were the people chanting?
Well, I mean, one of the problems with the march, it was actually smaller than was expected. A lot of that is because of the security issues. The march, along the march, many of the slogans were fairly anti-Jewish, anti-Israeli, reminding people of the early battles between Muhammad and the Jews. When they got there, however, the speeches were actually much more progressive. People, actually, some of the speakers were saying and begging people not to harm foreigners and telling them that the foreigners are here to work with us and help us. They were talking about democracy, unity, building democracy against what they call the Governed Council, and also just finding a peaceful way to resist the occupation in the long term. The other issue that was most interesting to people who were there was that it was also mostly men, and it's really still very hard for women to claim an active part in the public space, in part because of the horrible security situation.
Mark Levine, professor of University of California, Irvine, speaking to us from Baghdad, just a block from a major protest taking place. We now go to a man familiar to Democracy Now! Listeners. He was on the show a year ago from Baghdad when he said UK-USA means united to kill us all. Ghassan Al-Mukhtar is a retired engineer who lives with his family in Baghdad. Can you describe the situation in Iraq 1 year after the invasion began?
Well, Emmy, the invasion is nothing more than an extension of the sanction, except it's worse. The medical system has collapsed totally. Water supply and the sewage even deteriorated more. The security situation is atrocious. You cannot drive outside your house safely at night. The bombing is happening almost every day. We hear a bomb. In fact, we hear more bombs than it is reported on the on news media. Now that the telephone system, we are without a telephone system for now a year. I still don't have a telephone line. The landlines have been damaged totally. The health system just collapsed. So it is even worse than what it was a year ago. And there is no prospect of improvement within the foreseeable month or the next few months or a year even, because the attempt has, no attempt has been visible on the reconstruction of all those facilities. So I would say a year after the invasion, life is miserable in Baghdad. It was much more, it is a lot worse than it was in 2003.
We're talking to Ghassan Al-Mukhtar, a retired Iraqi engineer, talking to us from Baghdad. The attitude to U.S. soldiers?
Well, the attitude to U.S. soldiers are becoming more hostile because the U.S. soldiers are misbehaving and the mishandling the people. They are shooting more people. In fact, yesterday they killed a photographer and a journalist for Al Arabiya newspaper, according to the eyewitness reports and I have seen on television. Unjustifiably empty down, it is actually a cold-blooded murder of those two journalists, so that's bound to increase the resistance against the UN, the U.S. invasion. I was told today that the other part of Baghdad, which is al-Sadr city, which used to be called Saddam City, it's a predominantly Shiite area in Baghdad. There's a demonstration against the U.S. occupation of Iraq.
And finally, in terms... Go ahead, Ghassan.
So things are not improving. They are deteriorating and deteriorating rapidly. I was just traveling on the Amman to Baghdad road two nights ago, and we had to stop for 2 hours because it was dark, and we were chased by a pickup truck, which the driver said it was some sort of people trying to hijack the car, thieves on the road. So when we stopped about 60 kilometers or 70 kilometers from the Iraqi border inside Iraq, we stopped, couldn't travel because it was too dangerous. We found about more than 300 cars parked at a coffee shop, and we have to wait until about 5:30 in the morning so we can go on a convoy together.
Finally, you are an engineer. In terms of reconstruction, what has happened?
Visibly nothing. They painted a few schools, and they cleaned some of the rubble of the buildings that have been bombed. Let me give you an example, which is a telephone exchange which serves my area. In 1991, that building was totally demolished with all the equipment destroyed. We, the engineers of Iraq, were managed to clear the rubble, redesign the building it, equipping it, and have it operational in 3 to 4 months. Now, with a year after the occupation, by the way, we did that despite the sanctions, and we didn't have Bechtel, we didn't have Halliburton's, and we didn't have all those highly paid advisors. We did it in 3 months. Now, despite this, now a year after the invasion, they haven't rebuilt the building. They just rerouted the cables, put a container on the floor, on the ground, and they are trying to fix the telephone system. I still don't have a telephone after 3 years, after a year. I'm talking to you from a mobile phone that may or may not work. I have a backup system, another Soraya system, just in case things don't work out.
Well, Ghassan Al-Mokhtar, I want to thank you very much for being with us, a retired engineer speaking to us from Baghdad on this first anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. When we come back, we'll speak with two U.S. soldiers who have returned from Iraq. Stay with us.
Just around Basra also there are oil fields. Where are those?
There are oil fields. Oil fields tend to be in this area here.
Okay, what do you do about those?
Well, you probably would want to occupy them.
Or the Houthis pounding targets just across the border around the southern oil fields.
And U.S. and British forces captured key Iraqi oil fields. The oil fields intact, and large shipments of OPEC oil arrived in Western Europe and North America.
Stop the mass arrests. Stop the murder for profit. It's a war crime.
And very strong market gains. Be quick and successful. Drove stocks sharply higher again today. The Dow Jones Industrials posting an eighth straight daily gain and rounding out the best week in more than 20 years. American planes launched the shock and awe bombing campaign against Baghdad. Investors were buying stock.
Stop the war!
Why are we here?
Stop the war!
Why are we here?
Stop!
show what war looks like.
This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Monday, Staff Sergeant Camilo Mejia of the Florida National Guard surrendered to U.S. military police. He'd been on the run for 5 months after he refused to go back to Iraq to fight. After he surrendered, Mejia said, quote, "I'm saying no to war. I went to Iraq and was an instrument of violence, and now I've decided to become an instrument of peace." Mejia is now seeking conscientious objector status. He's one of an unknown number of soldiers who has returned from Iraq only to criticize U.S. foreign policy. One of these soldiers is Michael Hoffman, a former Marine artilleryman. A year ago today, he was preparing to go to Iraq. Tomorrow, he'll be stationed outside Fort Bragg in Fayetteville, North Carolina, not as a soldier, but as a protester. He'll be joining thousands at the protest, which is expected to be the largest anti-war rally outside a military base since the Vietnam War. And then there are soldiers like Cody, 21 years old, served in Iraq from March of last year to February. He recently returned home from leave. Today, he's speaking out on a national news program for the first time. To protect his identity, we refer to him by his first name. Unlike Michael Hoffman, his term is not over. In a few weeks, Cody's returning overseas to finish his duty, but he felt he had a need to speak out. We welcome Michael Hoffman and Cody to Democracy Now! Let us begin with Cody. Can you talk about your feelings today?
I certainly can, Amy. Which feelings would you like to hear about?
Well, can you talk about your experience in Iraq?
It wasn't any fun, first of all. And going into Iraq, there's a lot of ignorance going in as far as among the soldiers, because none of us really knew what we were there for. I mean, we knew we were there to fight Saddam, but that's about it. And then after Saddam was toppled, no one knows why we're staying there.
What made you decide to speak out against the invasion now for the first time?
Because now it's unraveling that because it's just at a standstill in that country at this point in time, and the only thing that's happening over there right now is like just contractors getting paid. It's not like we're rebuilding much.
What about these contractors like Halliburton?
Because before Halliburton, like, the living conditions in Iraq were just so horrible for anybody, including the U.S. soldiers. And then once they moved Halliburton in, you know, everyone getting their mail finally, and then everyone getting enough to eat finally. You know, we're all supposed to be happy, but, you know, we're still in Iraq for no clear reason.
What is the attitude of most of the soldiers that you work with, that you were in Iraq with?
Well, the soldiers I work with and myself, everyone, it's really a personal level. Everyone just finds their own way to deal with things, you know. And most of the time, it's just not like a healthy thing, you know.
Why do you think you're in Iraq fighting?
What do I think?
Yes.
I'm not sure what I can say or what I can't say, but, you know, it's just to finish that big oil pipeline. But, and it's just, you know, the only reason there's so many of us there is just because those contractors are making so much more money. And if there are maybe 10,000 soldiers there, then they wouldn't be making billions of dollars.
Cody, you spent a lot of time at the Abu Ghraib prison. What were you doing there?
I was providing like their communication support, their main means of communication, telephones, internet, secure internet.
How many people are being held at this prison?
At the time, there was about 200 when we first got there, and then they had switched over, like, the main core of the prison from just, you know, normal normal petty criminals, and then they started, they switched over and they started bringing in all the Fedayeen, you know, and people labeled as terrorists, it's people they wanted to interrogate.
And how many are there now?
I'm not sure now, because back, it was around September, October, they changed over and they changed the, they gave the prison over to the Iraqi guards. They had Iraqi guards.
We're also joined on the phone by Michael Hoffman. Michael Hoffman is a former Marine artilleryman in Iraq. You'll be outside Fort Bragg tomorrow, not as a soldier, but as a protester. Can you talk about your experience in Iraq?
My experiences were somewhat similar. Looking in there, a lot of the troops weren't sure of why they were there. And also a lot of them had a very good idea of why they were there, and it wasn't for the reasons we were given about weapons of mass destruction and getting rid of Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq. For us, it was actually the fact that we knew we were going in there about oil and money. Slightly before we left for Kuwait in February, our first sergeant addressed my unit after all the officers had left, and he told us, don't make any illusions that you're going over there about weapons of mass destruction, that you're going there to get rid of Saddam Hussein, you're going there for one reason, and that's oil. But he went on to tell us that you have to go because you signed a contract that said you would do as you're told. And on top of that, your friends were going over there, and you had an obligation, if not to the contract you signed, but to your friends who were going over there, that you have to do everything you can to make sure everyone comes back in one piece.
We're also joined by Christian Parenti, who has spent a good deal of time in Iraq, both embedded with U.S. troops, also interviewed Iraqi resistance fighters, both embedded with the 82nd Airborne and the Florida National Guard. Having interviewed Camilo Mejia extensively, it's coming out in the next issue of The Nation, the Florida National Guardsman who surrendered to U.S. military police, saying he will not return to fight in Iraq, has been on the run for 5 months. Your comments?
Well, I think that Camilo was incredibly brave and leading the way in refusing to go back to the killing fields of Iraq, and I would urge the soldier Cody to consider that example. The situation in Iraq is, you know, deteriorating, it seems, and I think that the contracting is central to it all. In this counterinsurgency war that the U.S. is now fighting there, the political and economic component would be essential for the U.S. to stabilize the situation. But the U.S. administration seems to be caught in an ideological bind. They're so obsessed with the cult of the market that they have allowed Halliburton to just steal all of the money that might otherwise stabilize the situation. And that translates directly into dead U.S. soldiers and dead Iraqi civilians.
Can you talk about the experience of the two different units you were embedded with?
The Florida National Guard unit that I spent time with in August was not very well supplied and morale was not super high. They were doing their best to carry on. And the 82nd Airborne, on the other hand, was fairly well supplied. They were on a shorter rotation and their morale was much higher. And I think that's an important point just in terms of people thinking about this war in terms of Vietnam. This war is very different from Vietnam. But to the extent that the army broke down in Vietnam, it was due to this large population of coerced draftees. And in the current situation, I think reservists and National Guardsmen are in many ways the new draftees. And it's interesting that their proportion of the total deployment is going up with this new rotation. Mm.
You also wrote about Al Jazeera going to jail. Can you talk about the reporter who was imprisoned?
Well, there were two reporters in Abu Ghraib, and I interviewed a number of people who had actually been in Abu Ghraib and had family in Abu Ghraib, and I went to Abu Ghraib. The guy I interviewed, Salah Hassan, is a cameraman, and he was arrested by U.S. forces and spent a month and a half being basically tortured in Abu Ghraib because the U.S. doesn't like Al Jazeera's reporting. And so he was stripped naked, kept awake for long periods of time, hooded, bound, made to wear a vomit-covered uniform, given no access to a lawyer, not told what was happening. And finally, due to pressure from Al Jazeera, he was released. And so too, after 2 months' detention, was his colleague. The specifics of those that detention should be put in a larger context of the U.S. really hating the fact that Al Jazeera reports critically on their occupation, and at the same time, the U.S. has launched this new satellite station called Al Hura, the free one, which is a U.S.-funded sort of answer to Al Jazeera. So at the same time that they're investing $100 million a year of taxpayers' money in their propaganda battle, they're trying to limit Al Arabiya and Al Jazeera and the other critical Arab language networks by arresting journalists, killing journalists. The governing council has banned Al Arabiya for 2 months, which is now over. Also banned Al Jazeera from covering their meetings. So all of this pressure, both the violence and the political pressure, is a form of censorship, essentially. And that, I think, relates to a larger point, which is fundamentally the situation in Iraq is still one of despotism. The basic structure that of Saddam society is still in place. You have random police searches and abuse of the population. You have massive use of detention. You have this form of press censorship. You have torture being used in Abu Ghraib, maybe not as excessively and as physically violent as Saddam used, but widespread psychological torture. You have hunger. You have a culture of spying and snitching, an incredible fear among Iraqis. And with the collapse of the education system, you also have a form of enforced ignorance. So you have all of the features of despotism and of a totalitarian society, but it's now run by the U.S. coalition.
I wanted to ask Cody, the soldier who is back from Iraq and now speaking out for the first time. Christian Parenti writes in The Nation about this reporter who was taken to Abu Ghraib, Salah Hassan, who worked for Al Jazeera. Once inside the sprawling prison, Hassan says he was greeted by U.S. soldiers who sang happy birthday to him through his tight plastic hood, stripped him naked, addressed him only as Al Jazeera boy or bitch. He was forced to stand hooded, bound, and naked for 11 hours in the bitter autumn night. When he fell, soldiers kicked his legs to get him up again. In the morning, he was made to wear a dirty red jumpsuit, which was covered with someone else's fresh vomit, and interrogated by Americans in civilian clothes. They made the usual accusations that Hassan and Al Jazeera were in cahoots with terrorists. You were at Abu Ghraib prison. Does this sound like anything that you saw or witnessed?
We heard about things. I mean, see, when they moved in the interrogators at the end of the summer, you know, they were kind of kept separate from the rest of the people that were there, the rest of the soldiers. So, thing is, I think that could have, I mean, I didn't see it personally, because we couldn't see the interrogations and things like that. And then all we would just catch word that there were new prisoners, you know, this and that. And, but I mean, it sounds very real. I could see it happening because, there's a lot of soldiers over there without guidance as far as what they're looking for, or, you know, they just bring in these people with, you know, tagged enemy. And, you know, everyone takes it upon themselves to try to treat them that way. But the question is just like, who's the enemy and who's not?
Cody, what is the attitude to a soldier like you who speaks out, or not even speaks out publicly like you are for the first time on national television and radio, but speaks out within your unit is critical?
Well, see, the thing about speaking out is there's a lot of questions about how you're going to be looked at after that. It's like, anyone that's anti-Bush or anti-war is going to be looked at like as a traitor. And I'm just trying to put out to everybody that you could love the Army and you could love America, and just because you don't want to be in Iraq doesn't make you a traitor to your country. Doesn't make you any less patriotic. But you're being labeled that way because you know, they're trying to suppress what the real morale is over there.
We're going to go to break. When we come back, we'll continue this discussion, and then we're going to hear from people around the world who are preparing for protests this weekend. This is Democracy Now! We're speaking with two U.S. soldiers who've returned from Iraq. One will be protesting tomorrow. The other will be going back, not exactly sure where, still part of the military. Christian Parenti with us as well, a journalist who is embedded with U.S. troops and also interviewed Iraqi resistance fighters. Stay with us. Rahim Alhaj here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In the last few days, Christian Parenti, author of an upcoming book on occupied Iraq, was interviewed on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. I wanted to play an excerpt of what you had to say.
Why are Iraqis so angry and willing to point the blame at the U.S. after this sort of bombing? A lot of it has to do with the failure of meaningful reconstruction. There still isn't adequate electricity. In many towns like Ramadi, when I was there, there wasn't adequate water. Where's all the money that's going to Halliburton and Bechtel to rebuild this country? Where is it ending up? And I think that is one of the most important fundamental causes of instability, is the corruption around the contracting with these Bush-connected firms in Iraq. And that unless that is dealt with, there's going to be much more instability for times to come in Iraq.
That was Christian Parenti on the air. What happened after that?
Well, then I went home and went to sleep, and the next morning I got a call from the producer, who's a very nice guy, Dan Segalin, and he was upset that I had been unbalanced. And I asked him what was unbalanced, and he said, well, it's nothing that you said was problematic, but that we didn't have someone to counter your points about Halliburton. And I said to him, but wait a minute, you don't have someone countering administration positions every time they're on. And he agreed that that was true. And he said, but, you know, overall, it all balances out. We get different positions on, and overall, it all balances out. And I said, well, then I don't understand why my comments won't be balanced out the next time you have someone from the administration or somewhere else on. And so then he hung up, and he was trying. I didn't really understand what he was getting at. And then he called back and said that Jim Lehrer was so upset that Jim Lehrer was going to read some sort of apology on the air, which I thought was ridiculous. But I was very flattered that he thought it was so important what I'd said. But.
Well, on March 4th, Jim Lehrer returned to the end of the show, at the end of the program, and read the following statement. For those who were watching two nights ago, a discussion about Iraq ended up not being as balanced as is our standard practice. While unintentional, it was indeed our mistake, and we regret it.
Surreal, is all I can say. I mean, I think what it shows is the ideological rigidity of that show and of most of the mainstream media in this U.S., in this country, that they could take issue with stating facts such as there is corruption in Halliburton, which is a Bush-connected firm. The Pentagon has begun criminal investigations against this firm. Its subsidiaries are continually giving back money for overcharging. There's nothing at all controversial about that point.
And the idea that you were a reporter brought on to report and not to express opinion?
Right. That was one argument they made. And I don't think I was, expressing opinion. I was referring to my experience in Iraq. And this is very palpable. People talk about the lack of reconstruction all the time, and I referred to that experience. It wasn't an opinion; it was facts. And you know, actually, if one did support this war, they should be very, very concerned about these issues. So I just saw it as
what do you mean
being
by that?
Overreaction. Well, I mean, I think that one of the main if the U.S. loses this counterinsurgency war, it will be primarily because it has completely messed up the political and economic side. Militarily, the U.S. has total dominance, but in all guerrilla wars, the political and economic side is key. That's how the Brits won in Malaysia, was by really creating a functioning, legitimate government. That's why the U.S. lost in Vietnam, is that it could not create a functioning, legitimate puppet government or create meaningful economic reform. So if in 5 years down the line the resistance has grown, the U.S. is beleaguered, the army is breaking down and about to pull out, a lot of that will have to do with the fact that billions upon billions of dollars had just been literally given away to these firms that then don't repair the roads, don't repair the sewers, don't repair the water, don't repair the electrical systems or the telephone systems, and in the process, don't hire Iraqis to do this, and succeed in alienating the population there.
Michael Hoffman, former Marine artilleryman, served in Iraq from March to May. What will be your major statement tomorrow outside Fort Bragg?
There's going to be 2 points I'm really going to be trying to make tomorrow. The first is that the active duty reservists and the recent veterans from Iraq, if they feel that the war is wrong, they need to start speaking out, just like Cody has, and I have been, and the number is slowly growing. I mean, just recently, with all the returning troops from Iraq, the numbers are slowly starting to grow. For a while, I was honestly, as far as I knew, the only one publicly speaking out, but of course, as you can see, that's slowly starting to change. The other message I always try to stress is the fact that, or it's not the fact, but the way the administration is avoiding the real cost of the war. They're constantly broadcasting the total number of deaths there, but they're not talking about what those deaths mean here to the families, and they're also not talking about the mental and physical wounds that are happening over there. I was at the protest this Monday at Walter Reed Memorial Hospital. And there was a counter-protest there saying, don't use our wounded as propaganda tools. And our response was, we're not using them as propaganda tools. We're simply trying to make people aware that they're here, which is something I feel many, many Americans aren't aware of at all.
Cody, I give you the last word. You're on temporary leave. Where do you head now? Where will you be deployed?
I'm going back to Germany.
Would you go to Iraq if you were told you had to?
It depends on what means I'd be sent. If it meant keeping somebody else back, then yeah, I'd go in their place, but I wouldn't go voluntarily.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Cody, who's does not want to use his full name, speaking out on temporary leave from deployment in Iraq, and Michael Hoffman, former Marine artilleryman, will be at Fort Bragg tomorrow. Christian Parenti, contributing writer to The Nation magazine, author of the forthcoming book, The Freedom, Shadows and Hallucinations in Occupied Iraq. Thank you for being with us. As we turn finally today to the protests that will be taking place this weekend around the world to mark the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, people in cities and countries will take to the streets to protest the invasion and the ongoing occupation of Iraq. Producer Shroof Abdelkaddous called people in many different cities and countries. This is a sampling of what they had to say.
My name is Marielle Nanassi, and I am with the Action Coalition of Taos, ACT, in Taos, New Mexico. Donald Rumsfeld has a number of estates in Taos, New Mexico, and claims that this is his home. We have built a 15-foot effigy of Dr. Strangefeld, that's what we call him locally. It is Rumsfeld on a missile. He's hugging a missile, and he has the Dr. Strangelove black gloves holding it. And on the missile, which stands about 20 feet, it says USA WMD. And we are holding a rally on March 20th, joining the worldwide demonstrations calling for regime change in the United States and an end to the occupation in Iraq and no more wars by this administration.
My name is Anne Shirazi. I live in New York City, and I am marching with United for Peace and Justice on March 20th because this is the first anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. We were out on February 15th trying to stop the invasion, and now we are out on the first anniversary of the invasion of Iraq because more and more people are realizing that this occupation is resulting in deaths, more and more deaths and maiming of American soldiers, more and more deaths and maiming of innocent Iraqi people. And we're hoping that we will have many, many people out on March 20th. There will be speakers, including Denis Kucinich, a presidential candidate who happens to be the only person who's of that kind who spoke on February 15th and is now coming back on the anniversary to speak with us again, and is the only candidate who seems to understand that we have to stop all the lies and stop all the killing.
My name is Gajra Zuki, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Stop the War Coalition from London, England. And on Saturday, March the 20th, in London, tens of thousands of people will be joining demonstrators around the world, including many in the United States of America, to commemorate the start of the war on Iraq. On the demonstration, which we expect, as I said, to be very, very big, at the end of it, we will be rallying in central London, and we will hold a minute's silence for all the Iraqi civilians that have died as a result of this illegal, unjust war. All the American, British, and other coalition soldiers that have been killed as a result of this war. And we will be remembering the Spanish and the people that were killed in Madrid last week. We'll be releasing thousands of balloons to mark their deaths. And the theme of the demonstration is A Year of Lies.
My name is Sandra Schwartz. I work for the American Friends Service Committee in the Peace Education Division, and we are members of the United for Peace and Justice Coalition in San Francisco. I want to tell you about two events that are happening this weekend. On Friday, March 19th at 5 p.m., we will be gathering for an interfaith memorial to mourn the loss of human life and to redirect our energies toward a more peaceful future. We especially mourn those who have died in Iraq, but we also mourn those that the many other casualties that have taken place in the past year. We are aware that the cost of destruction in one place is paid for by deprivation in another. Some people will be vigiling all night long and then meeting the mobilization, which is taking place on Saturday at Dolores Park in San Francisco. There will be speeches and music, and then marching to the Civic Center.
My name is Joe Moore. I'm a member of the City Council of the City of Chicago, Illinois. I was the lead sponsor of a resolution that the City Council of Chicago passed last year against the preemptive military invasion of Iraq. And shortly after the president announced that the United States was invading Iraq, there was a massive anti-war demonstration held in the city of Chicago, and after the demonstration, an impromptu march was conducted. The march ended on a sour note when over 800 demonstrators were arrested really without probable cause and were detained overnight without the benefit of attorneys. And on the anniversary of both the invasion of Iraq and those unlawful arrests, another demonstration is being held at the location where those arrests were made. And we are going to be marching in solidarity not only with those who oppose the invasion of Iraq and the continued military occupation of that country, but also in solidarity with those who were arrested without cause for exercising their First Amendment rights. And we're marching at the same place that those arrests took place. Unfortunately, the mayor and the city leaders have not seen fit to grant a permit. Nonetheless, the demonstrators and myself feel very strongly about the fact that we should be allowed to exercise our First Amendment rights, and that given the importance of the issues at stake, that we'd be allowed to march.
My name is Sheila Stump. I live at Haley House, the Boston Catholic Worker. And last year, on December 29th, over the Feast of the Holy Innocents, I took part in a Faith and Resistance retreat. That is a gathering of different Catholic worker and resistance communities. And part of that retreat, we went to the Pentagon to protest the planning for and preparing for and actually carrying out of war that is planned for in that building. And as part of our protest, my partner Scott Langley and I walked up to the pillars and poured our blood on the pillars of the Pentagon to expose the bloodiness that that is prepared for in that building, because war is the preparation for bloodshed. Tomorrow on March 19th, Scott and I go to trial in Alexandria, Virginia, on two charges, and which hold 6 months each, and we expect to spend time in prison. So during the March 20th rally in New York City, we'll probably be spending time in prison, but we'll hold the protest in our hearts and continue to struggle for peace and justice behind the prison walls.
My name is Lola Sullivan. I am from Spain, and I represent the Arab Coast Solidarity Committee and the Spanish campaign for lifting the sanctions on Iraq. Regarding the 20th March International Day Against Occupation of Iraq and Palestine, we are preparing here many, many demonstrations, more than 50 demonstrations in the main cities in all over the country. And we hope that this year, after 1 year of the invasion of Iraq, everybody will go out to the streets, will take the streets to protest against the invasion and against the occupation of Iraq. Especially now in this moment, that after 11th March, and especially after the last elections, the presidential elections that we held last weekend, we got to take out of the power the Spanish government that put us in the invasion of Iraq and that sent our troops to occupy Iraq. And regarding this also, we hope that the next prime minister of the new government in Spain will fulfill his electoral promise of retreating, of taking out the Spanish troops from Iraq. And these are our main demands for the next 20th March demonstration. And of course, we are, all of us, I mean, I think that more than 85% of the Spanish people are against occupation, and I hope that we hope that people will take the streets again and will show their anger against this unfair and illegitimate occupation in Iraq.
Some of the voices of people around the world who will be protesting this weekend on this first anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. And that does it for today's program, Democracy Now!, produced by the remarkable Democracy Now! Team, Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, John Hamilton. Special thanks to Uri Galed and Simba Russo and John Randolph and Johnny Sender and Angela Alston and Chris Zucker, Rich Kim, Dennis Moynihan, Karen Renucci, the whole team here. Also to our hosts here, Downtown Community Television, Keiko Tsuno, and John Alpert, who's helped so much with the Haiti coverage preparations to go on that trip as the delegation went to escort President Aristide from Central African Republic to Jamaica, where he is now. If you'd like to go to our website, democracynow.org, you can see that special coverage and tell your friends and emails around Aristide Returns, exclusive Haiti coverage. That does it for the show. Our website, democracynow.org. If you'd like to get a copy, 1-800-881-2359. Tune in tomorrow to Pacifica Special Coverage. We'll be based at Fort Bragg in North Carolina, the Pacifica team with voices of people around the country. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.